1920s, reacting to the First World War and the Red Scare that followed, America went on a binge. The country plunged into the age of the flapper, of dancers doing the Charleston, of nude young ladies dunking themselves in tubs of champagne. It was a carefree age, an age that created the image of Hollywood sirens of secret love nests and the amorous adventures of Rudolph Valentino. It was also an age of violence, prohibition, rum runners who shot it out with the cops, bloody gang wars and gunmen's mauls. Confronted by this happy spectacle, the nation's press outdid itself, and out in front was a new form of paper, the tabloid. The first of these, the Illustrated Daily News, was soon joined by others, anxious for the profits that went with a growing circulation. The result was a decade of jazz journalism, which has left its mark on the American press down to this day.
WNBC TV Public Affairs, in cooperation with the Graduate School of Journalism, Columbia University, presents News in America, the Lively Art of Journalism. With your hosts, Professors William A. Wood and Lawrence Pinkham, Graduate School of Journalism, Columbia University. Today, the people's right to know. Now here is Professor Wood.
Journalism in this century has gone up and down a zigzag graph which corresponded roughly with the events, the moods, the themes, and changes in the country during this period of time. World War I began 50 years ago, and there have been, in those 50 years, immense change in our country. There was a decade in the 20s of carefree prosperity, a decade in the 30s of grimness and depression. A great global war which lasted 4 years and killed millions of men. And since that time, a Cold War which intermittently has become hot. During this period, the press, radio, television have risen to great heights, done good things and at times bad things, but never worse than in the era of the 20s known as the age of jazz journalism. The 2,000 daily newspapers then in print, most of them followed this lead. But of all these, it was a new form of newspaper, the tabloid, which outdid them all.
And this is the one that started it all. The Illustrated Daily News, today known as the New York Daily News, its first issue had on its front page, as we can see here, a picture of the Prince of Wales, who was later to become King of England. Its headline was, in fact, Hard News. It was founded in 1919 and antedated the 20s by 1 year. And the headline says, Germans block signing of treaty. It was interested in news, but it was also interested in some other things because the next headline under it says, Newport to entertain Prince of Wales in August. And this was the beginning of a period in which royalty and celebrities, socialites, and others would become very important in terms of the news. The Illustrated Daily News was founded, as I noted, in 1919 by a man named Joseph Medill Patterson. He had been a partner of Robert McCormick in the Chicago Tribune, and word in the history books tells us that Mr. McCormick was not particularly sorry to see Mr. Patterson leave and found a new kind of American journalism and a new paper, because Mr. Patterson was considered by his confreres in those days to be a socialist of sorts, which may come as somewhat of a surprise to current daily news readers. The Daily News had a very simple formula, but like all simple things, it had to be worked out. It now seems simple now that we have it. It used a lot of pictures, as we've seen its first page, which I really feel has a great deal of dignity. It's a page I like. It had a great full picture on it. It appealed, as Hearst and Pulitzer had with their newspapers before it, to the poor, to the immigrants, to those people at the bottom of the economic and the social ladder. I would say that pretty much it still does that today, although it's very happy to have anyone who wants to come along and put his money down and buy it. It was a great success right away. By 1921, it had equaled the circulation of Hearst's Evening Journal, that was then riding very high in New York City. And by 1924, which was only 5 years after its founding, it had surpassed all the New York newspapers and was selling 750,000 copies a day. It had found its formula by then. It had short, snappy stories, wisecracking headlines, pictures, and obviously a broad popular appeal.
jail ex-bunny as jury fixer. Another nice thing about the tabloid was its convenient size. It was actually only half the size of the conventional page of the papers up to that time. But the Illustrated Daily News invited and, in fact, gave birth to almost immediate competition, didn't it, Larry?
Yes. Even in those days, there were ex-bunnies or something similar. And other newspapers found out about them. The first was William Randolph Hearst, the man who had already been bested by Patterson's tabloid. So Hearst came back with one of his own in 1924. He established the Daily Mirror. And we see here, it looks a bit like the sports page on the front. Polo player, headline says, Prince plays Sunday polo. Quite an event, apparently, because this actually was the front page. And this was, as I noted before, royalty was of great interest in those days. In fact, this paper always reminds me of an old adage about what made for really striking news in the days of the 20s. It was said that every story should have a reference to a deity, a reference to royalty, which we've seen here, and a bit about sex, if possible. And the ideal story in those times would have started off under that formula, something like, good Lord, cried the Queen, get your hand off my knee.
Perfect, perfect.
I don't know that this next newspaper ever did that, but it certainly was capable of having done it. this was the New York Evening Graphic, which also came along in 1924, established by Bernard McFadden, better known for his physical culture magazines. It's pretty hard from looking at this, at least the mirror says the prince is playing Sunday polo. It's pretty hard to know what's happening here. Headline says, Seeks Gem Raffles. Hijacker's ring here is bared. Everything was being bared in those days, and if it was legs, it was preferable. The graphic really wasn't a newspaper at all. I think almost everyone would agree with that. It had no wire service, as most newspapers by that time did, to gather national and international news. It didn't cover much news, as a matter of fact, unless it was news of a particular kind, sensational sort of thing, et cetera.
The sensational gave these people a chance to cover, and they certainly did, the crime and court stories of the time.
Right, right. A big one of those was the Ruth Snyder and the Judd Gray murder case. Mrs. Snyder got together with an accomplice. This was in the middle of the 1920s, after both these newspapers had come along to challenge the New York Daily News. Mrs. Snyder got together with a corset salesman, which named Judd Gray. Yes, his name was Judd Gray. I have it written here. He was a corset salesman, and this fitted in very well reasons that would appear, I suppose, to be apparent. They got together, and according to the conviction in their trial, did away with the unwanted Mrs. Snyder. Grim things followed. Mrs. Snyder was sentenced to be executed in the electric chair at Sing Sing Prison. And the New York Graphic, rising to the moment, made a great promise to its readers, which I think, if you could read that, Bill, it would give us some sense of what this newspaper was and did.
It'll be a pleasure, Larry. Don't fail to read tomorrow's Graphic, an installment that thrills and stuns, a story that fairly pierces the heart and reveals Ruth Snyder's last thoughts on Earth, that pulses the blood as it discloses her final letters. Think of it, a woman's final thoughts just before she's clutched in the deadly snare that sears and burns and fries and kills. Her very last words, exclusively in tomorrow's Graphic. How did this all come out the next day?
I've always wondered how many books of synonyms they had to consult to find all those fries and kills and burns and sears and all the rest. What readers the next day saw as they reached for their New York Graphic was not the most sensational thing, was not the New York Graphic at all, but the edition of the New York Daily News, with a picture on its cover, in fact, taken of Ruth Snyder in the electric chair at Sing Sing as she was electrocuted at the moment of electrocution. Now, this is pretty grim stuff, without question. The news justified doing what it did. It sent a photographer up there with a small, very primitive camera attached to his leg. And he was part of the press corps that witnessed the execution as a standard business. What wasn't standard is that he calculated the moment, pulled up his trouser leg, snapped a cord that extended into his pocket, and then quietly, with the others, left the room.
And the news got the big play.
The news got the big play. They raced the picture back with two cars in case one car broke down. They raced the picture back to the news building in New York City. It became their front page. And I must say, though it's grim, it certainly got great acceptance. It immediately sold 250,000 extra copies. And after that, they had to run off another 750,000 to satisfy public demand. A total of 1 million extra copies for this page. And as you can see by the very use in this program, it is still around.
It certainly is, and has come a long way since those days.
The news, I think, lasted probably because it did, in spite of the fact that it spent a great deal of time doing this sensational kind of thing, it also paid attention to the news. By the time of the Wall Street crash in 1929, it had 1,300,000 readers every day, more readers probably, it sold that many papers. And in World War II, it passed the 2 million mark, more than any other newspaper in America, and 3 million on Sunday. And it continues to sell pretty much at that rate, although I think its circulation has fallen off a little bit most recently. I think the reason it did survive, the graphic went to an early deserved grave. The Mirror left us a couple of 3 years ago, unmourned, at least by me. The Daily News stuck to the news, and I think this example of a current issue makes the point. It has as its headline something that's very important to all Americans at the time of this issue, certainly. Three U.S. divisions face Viet call. It had stuck with the idea of news as it developed, as we'll see in a moment. But it could not still, I think, it can't even currently resist the temptation to do a little bit of the old frisky business, which we find usually, and I'm doing a great ad for the news here, because you look on page 4, you find this sort of thing sometimes. This happens to be a story here about a lady with a very curious jeweled adornment which goes somewhere around her waist. Am I being too testy for television?
I understand this.
I think at the time it was also used on television. As someone has said, I think a writer in The New Yorker, there'll always be an ad man, and he scored there, certainly.
Well, came, Larry, the Great Depression, which was very sobering, of course, with its unemployment, its rough times for many people.
Right.
And it sobered the world of journalism. And journalism changed a good deal during the period of the 30s. Not, in fact, that it left out or forgot about the sensational and exciting stories of the day. There were many, like the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and the Hauptmann trial, which followed, the Dion quintuplets, which
all
certainly
five of them, I
was
believe.
All five, which was a world story if there ever was one. A number of important prize fights during this period
Joe
that
Lewis,
were
I remember
well covered. John Dillinger.
And the woman in red. I've always, you suppose they told her to wear red, she betrayed him, perhaps.
And even Wrong Way Corrigan, who didn't end up where he said he was going to.
Corrigan, Ireland, I believe that was.
Yeah.
Big stories of their day, yes.
But all through the 30s, there was this social upheaval, the New Deal, changes were coming, and there were some problems in the world of the newspapers.
In the 30s, I think probably the major problem was the chain newspaper, what was considered a chain newspaper, and this is a newspaper owned by one man or one group, having many newspapers in many cities. By 1935, there were 63 of these chains. They controlled 41% of the daily circulation in the United States, so you can see that's quite a lot, and more than half of the Sunday circulation. There was great concern, particularly in the New Deal of the time, which was very liberal, that these chains, through what came to be known as press lords, the owners, would speak with a voice even stronger than that of government. The person they were really concerned about is that bad boy of American journalism, and he comes up again and again, although I'm sure he cried all the way to the bank when he was called that. William Randolph Hearst was really the person that they were most worried about. He had 25 newspapers in 1935, and they were in 19 cities, 26 dailies, I think, as a matter of fact, in 19 cities. They did speak with one voice. The editorials came down, signed the chief, and that was it.
But the fears of this time were not actually realized.
No. It turned out, like many other things in the 1930s, not to be economically very feasible to have all these newspapers. And the numbers subsided. I think if you take a look at Hearst today, for instance, the Hearst organization, although its founder is gone, has 10 newspapers in a total of 8 cities. And this is a great shrinking back from that original figure that concerned everybody in the 30s.
Now, another problem that was there and is still spoken of today is the business of monopoly of a newspaper in a town.
Right, right. This is another, this is a word that it's like chain newspapers. Publishers hate the word chain newspaper. They think it carries over these connotations from the 30s. They don't like the word monopoly. I must say, not being a publisher, it doesn't particularly scare me. I remember it as a game I used to play in the 1930s while everybody else was worrying about chain newspapers. But monopoly is very much with us, and if we may use that word, and I'm going to use it anyway, so it doesn't make any difference, I guess. There are now in the United States fewer than 61 cities that have competing newspapers. Unless you convert this into a percentage, I don't think it's very meaningful. Only 4% of American cities have a competing newspaper. In other words, they have only one newspaper.
That's a pretty startling thing.
Yes, and if you turn it around, I think it's even more startling in a sense that 96% of American cities have only one editorial voice coming off the printed page. And of course, it's not just the editorial, it's the way the news is covered and the general slant of the newspaper.
But one thing we have in this century in journalism is the fact that the print word is not the only way people get their news.
Right.
And even in the case of the monopoly you're talking about, we now have radio and television everywhere.
Right. We also have news magazines, of course, the weekly news magazine. Someone did a survey. Someone's always doing surveys, and they did a survey on where weekly news magazines sold the most. They found at the time, which is 4 or 5 years ago, they sold the most in newspapers with poor newspapers, in newspapers with poor cities. That couldn't even be right, could it? In cities with poor newspapers. The only problem about television, of course, is whether or not the same person owns it as owns a newspaper, and that could conceivably be a problem, although it hasn't risen as a... I haven't heard any great complaints voiced about that yet.
Now, let me be the historian for a moment again, Larry,
yes,
and say
will.
That these massive social forces were at work. They had their effect on the press. There were great changes during the New Deal period. Science and technology, as we all know, has leapt forward in the last 20 years.
Even in the printing of newspapers, it's...
There's the involvement in World War II, and in July of 1945, on a desert flat in Alamogordo, New Mexico, an event which was to change the world and mankind, the explosion of the atomic bomb. The rise of the mushroom cloud into the sky served notice that the world was not ever going to be the same again. Now, actually, the issue seemed to be human survival.
And just as the world was never going to be the same again, when this cloud did rise over the desert flat and later over Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it was clear that not only the world but journalism had a great new and difficult role to play. This was articulated shortly after this event, as a matter of fact, by a very astute editor, Erwin Canham, who is editor of the Christian Science Monitor, published in Boston, who only a few months after the explosion of the atomic bomb wrote the following.
Mere publication of spot news in newspapers is not enough. The news must be clarified, explained, interpreted, and integrated with other news. Big news stories of the world can no longer be covered by a bright boy just off the police beat. It takes a good man to explain to the lay reader the workings of the atomic bomb.
Of course, the implications of this new kind of event, this new sort of reporting, this new requirement for the press were vast. For many years, as a result primarily of a kind of reaction to the jazz journalism of the 20s, to the yellow journalism that had preceded it, to the reporting of say, the Lindbergh baby kidnapping, although it was certainly widely popular at the time, not the kidnapping, but the reading of it was an event that had great popularity in terms of readership. The reaction to all of this had been a kind of objectivity, and that's the great word for many years in journalism. All you do is print what the man said, and you let the facts speak for themselves. Now the facts were no longer necessarily speaking for themselves, and the press came into a new role and a time of journalism which has come to be called interpretive journalism. In a sense, it came more fully into what Jefferson had described as its role as watchdog of the nation. One person who had been a reporter himself in Washington titled a book on Washington correspondence, The Fourth Branch of Government. So here was the newspaper now, suddenly with a new responsibility, which certainly it hadn't asked for, but like many responsibilities had been thrust upon it, more fully than ever before involved in protecting the people's right to know. And I think we ought to make that point, since that really is what our program is about today, Bill.
But the people's right to know also has a corollary in this day and age. How much should the people know? How much can the people know? In a time of national security problems and Cold War, perhaps even more delicate than in a full-fledged world conflict like World War II, you find that there are certain things that for the good of the country cannot be said at a given time. And this brings up the question of the problem of keeping the people informed and yet also paying attention to national security. It's pointed up in something James Reston calls the Department of Dirty Tricks. This New York Times reporter says this about the Central Intelligence Agency, which really is a secret intelligent operation, which means that the press cannot report everything it does and the people can't know everything it does. In effect, it's a hidden government. And this sort of thing, as it goes on, creates problems of its own. One of them was the famous story of the U-2 incident. Larry?
Yes, for the first time, many of these things had been happening before, but for the first time it was very clear in the wake of the U-2 incident, in which a spy plane, U.S. spy plane, was shot down over the Soviet Union, that a government spokesman gave false information, a lie, to put it in its most bald form, to the public. Now, there's great argument about whether he really knew the facts or whether he was first given the lie, but this was dished out, and embarrassingly so, because then the Russians produced the plane and the flyer, and so it was clear by that time that the United States had done it, and the denial that it had done it was not true. Another example of government fiasco in which the press became involved was the Cuban invasion of the Bay of Pigs in 1961. A great mismanaged operation, largely by the CIA, in which one argument goes that full newspaper coverage, there was some newspaper coverage, but that full newspaper coverage of preparations and a debate on this sort of thing would have made it possible to correct a mismanaged and bad policy. There's another view of this, which was enunciated shortly after the event by President Kennedy, who took full responsibility for the Bay of Pigs and must have been a little bit stung by it. He presented the other view, and perhaps I should read the brief quote from him. He went before a publisher's meeting to say this, and said it pointedly and directly, as he did so many things. And I'm quoting now from President Kennedy after the Bay of Pigs. He told the publishers, quoting, "These are times that appeal to every citizen's sense of sacrifice and self-discipline. I am asking the members of the newspaper profession and the industry in this country to examine their own responsibilities, to consider the degree and the nature of the present danger, and to heed the duty of self-restraint which that danger imposes upon us all. Every newspaper now asks itself, with respect to every story, is it news? All I suggest is that you add the question, is it in the interest of national security?"
Well, that was 1961. 2 years later came the Cuban Missile Crisis. And at this time, President Kennedy actually manipulated the news, Larry.
I think what happened here, really, is that Kennedy decided not to leave it up to the press. He felt that this was an incident with great international implications, and he simply staged it, in a sense. The public was told he returned from Chicago suddenly because he had a cold, and he didn't have a cold. And it wasn't until the following evening, a Monday evening, as I recall, before he went before the nation, said a blockade had been established. He didn't like that word, but that's in effect what it was. And until finally the Russians backed down and didn't send their ships in, the news was very tightly managed. This was acknowledged right after the event by an assistant secretary of defense at the Pentagon, who got into a bit of a snarl with reporters about what had happened and why this had happened. And he said, and I'm quoting again, and I think this puts it as clear as possible, "The generation of news by actions taken by the government becomes one weapon in a strained situation. The results, in my opinion, justify the methods we use." So here we saw that government was using the press, in a sense, as a weapon, in addition to simply having its events reported.
Now, let me point this out, Larry, that management of the news by government is really nothing new. It's probably been true as long as there have been governments.
Right.
And the good reporter, though his job is tougher, gets the story anyway. He must be careful, of course, that he isn't used by a managing government news operation so that he is putting out leaks or other deliberate things that may mislead him and the public. And also, these days, it's true that any good reporter knows more than he can print for security reasons, and this puts an especial responsibility on him. But I think it's time we talked about a specific reporter and his problems in covering Vietnam.
Yes, well, this was a fellow who did the thing exactly the other way around. He decided not necessarily what he shouldn't print, but what he should print. David Halberstam, who had great difficulty for a whole variety of reasons, but largely because he went out there to Vietnam in 1962 as a fiery young reporter and found that everything was false. The Premier Diem was not popular. The Strategic Hamlet program wasn't working. In a sense, the American officials were really being taken in by a bunch of self-serving local Vietnamese. The furor was great. Time magazine attacked him openly so badly that their correspondent out there quit. The president suggested to his publisher that he be reassigned, and it's to the eternal... I think the publisher should be eternally grateful to the publisher that not only did he not reassign him, but he kept him on for several weeks after he was supposed to go on vacation, so the president wouldn't think that the New York Times had knuckled under.
And it's a happy upshot. Halberstam won just about every prize in sight for the work he did.
It's a success
story. And certainly time since then has proved that the story he was giving out was the truth.
Yes, I think the headline we showed before from the Daily News here about divisions going to Vietnam and so forth is certainly...
Now, the press, if it's going to be a fighting press to bring the story to everyone, has got to expect to be on the hot seat, has got to expect criticism from the government.
Yes, I think even now, it's just recently in the summer, after coming back from a tour of Vietnam, Senator Dodd attacked the press on the floor of Congress in a speech that ran 12 pages in the Congressional Record. He said he didn't like the way the press was reporting it. Fortunately, another man rose to the defense of the press, which doesn't always happen. Senator Mike Mansfield, who's the majority leader, rose and defended the press, said it had a responsibility to do what it was doing, and it was not up to government to tell the press what to do. I suppose we're biased, but I think that's the view that we would concur in, isn't it?
Well, I think in a democracy, Larry, aside from matters that are clearly national security, that if the government chooses to shield the public, to not let them know everything that's going on because it may look bad for that government, then it's up to the press to do this job. They've got to, even if the government doesn't like it. It seems to me this is important to the continuation of a free press and our democracy.
Yes, I'd say there are almost times when the worth of the press is, it can be measured by the amount of heat it excites and by the amount of criticism it gets. That's not always true, but this role of the press in the people's right to know has grown up with the press in America. It was certainly part of the role in the early revolutionary patriotic papers. Thomas Jefferson's time when he called it the watchdog of the nation, and certainly down to today. This is what the press is all about, the people's right to know.
So if there's conflict between the press and the federal government, perhaps this isn't altogether an unhealthy state of affairs. That's today's program. Next time, we're going to take a look at a very special instrument of journalism, the cartoon, on News in America.
WNBC TV Public Affairs, in cooperation with the Graduate School of Journalism, Columbia University, has presented News in America, the lively art of journalism, with your hosts, Professors William A. Wood and Lawrence Pinkham, Graduate School of Journalism, Columbia University. This program was pre-recorded.